today on the 21st show, part two of our conversations on policy in this year's presidential election. This time we're covering economic issues. The campaign has put a spotlight on the cost of childcare and led to conversations on price controls. Beyond that, Donald Trump has proposed major tariffs on all imported goods. We'll talk about the economic consequences of that for Illinoisans and go through some of the competing policy proposals from the campaigns and their backers, including Kamala Harris's New Way Forward, Trump's Agenda 47, and the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025. We'll also take your questions about the candidates in the economy at 800-222-9455. I'm Brian Mackey, and that's all coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. But first, the news from NPR. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. With voting in this year's election already underway in most of the country, the economy is top of mind. When the Pew Research Center asked registered voters about their top issues a couple months ago, roughly 8 out of 10 said it was very important to their decision. That explains why Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump have spent a lot of time talking about the economy during the campaign.
My plan is about saying that when you invest in small businesses, you invest in the middle class, and you strengthen America's economy.
On my first day back in the Oval Office, I will sign an executive order directing every cabinet secretary and agency head to use every tool and authority at their disposal to defeat inflation and to bring consumer prices rapidly down.
It is not right that teachers and nurses and firefighters are paying a higher tax rate than billionaires and the biggest corporations. I plan on making that fair.
It will be a whole of government effort to raise the standard of living and make American life affordable again.
Here in Illinois, the economic stakes are high. We've got the fifth largest GDP, or gross domestic product, of any state. There's a lot to talk about with this, and we're going to spend most of the show today doing just that. A little later in the hour, we'll talk about the big tariff proposals in this year's election and the effects those could have on our economy, especially with regard to agriculture. And toward the end of the hour, we'll talk more about some of the other stakes for ag beyond tariffs. But we begin with a big picture perspective on the economy and how we as Illinoisans and Midwesterners are experiencing it. With us to talk about that is Dr. Bonnie Wilson. She's an associate professor in the Department of Economics at Chaffetz School of Business, which is in St. Louis University. She also earned her master's degree and PhD in econ from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Bonnie, welcome to the 21st Show. Welcome back.
Well, thank you for the warm welcome, Brian. It is good to be back, even if from a distance on the radio, and I'm very glad to be with you.
And listeners, we welcome your thoughts and questions throughout the show today at 800-222-9455. What do you think of how the economy is doing? What changes would you like to see in our economic policy? And how do you think the campaigns are doing in addressing your concerns? Again, join the conversation at 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. All right, Bonnie, it's one thing to say the economy is the top concern for 8 of 10 voters. I would guess if you asked those 8 voters what they meant by that, you would probably get 8 different answers. We certainly heard that from our listeners. We got a text from Sue in Elgin who says, yes, prices are unaffordable for childcare, food, housing, and health care. And then she went on to talk about the difference single-payer health care would make for our economy. We also heard from Christina in Rock Falls who said, we are all working and making our bills, so I'd say that matches reports of low unemployment and a strong economy. I'd like to see the federal restoration of reproductive rights and protections for LGBTQ. I think we need more avenues to legal immigration. And finally, with my retirement planned in 5 to 7 years, it's important that my Social Security and health insurance is protected, Christina said. All right, we're going to get into some of those specific issues in a moment, but those messages raise the point that there's so much to our economy beyond GDP and unemployment rates. So, Bonnie, as an economist, how do you think about what we mean when we talk about the economy?
Well, for the most part, as an economist, big picture, I think of this in terms of what economists call economic freedom. Economic freedom has a number of components. It's about freedom to trade internationally. It's about limited regulation, but importantly, the kind of regulation targeted at addressing market failures. It's about sound fiscal and monetary policy. It's about a legal system that protects people and their property. Big picture, we know that economic freedom, as gauged by those sorts of things, really is the path to prosperity and human flourishing more generally. But I think it's also really important, as you indicated in those quotes, to dig down deeper underneath and actually to look at things like GDP and unemployment rates. And when we look across a wide array of metrics for the economy, it's actually very clear that people are better off today than they were 4 years ago. There's that question, the way a lot of people frame things in their mind when they're trying to make decisions about voting.
They are, because 4 years ago we were in the midst of the pandemic still, perhaps. So why is it then that so many people say they don't feel better off, right? We've heard a lot about vibes this election cycle, and people feel unsettled economically.
Yeah, in certain ways that seems right when you listen to what people say. I gather a lot of people are expressing concerns, but there's also some evidence that those sentiments are beginning to change. For example, consumer confidence polls, the latest ones are up. There's still the level of consumer confidence is still within the range it's been in the last couple of years, but it is up. And as an economist, I have to say, even while I am not willing to dismiss people's sentiments and what they say, I put more stock in what they actually do. And one of the things that we've seen in recent data, the data that came out on GDP growth just yesterday, is that consumption growth is very, very strong. Real GDP growth clocked in yesterday for the third quarter at 2.8%. That's a good showing relative to the norm of 2%. And when you dig down under the hood there, you see that consumption growth is strong, suggesting that consumers are confident. Equipment investment is also very strong, suggesting that firms are confident. Real wages are up, especially for younger and low-income workers. That wage growth is slowing, but it's still higher than inflation. Groceries are actually more affordable than they were in 2019. Household wealth relative to income is up, especially among younger households. Home ownership is up. Debt burdens are down. When you look at all of these things, people are doing better.
People are doing better. So, and the evidence is they're still going to Disney World. They're still buying that bacon, even if they want to complain about the price of it. So let's bring this back into the realm of politics then. So we're talking about the presidential campaigns. What sort of power does a president actually have in the economic performance of the nation and its people?
So my own sense, well, policy certainly matters. And there may not be much that the executive branch can do on its own, although many of the things that former President Trump has proposed with respect to tariffs, he might be able to do through executive order. But by and large, there's what the president can do is certainly limited. I think that's the subtext of your question. So does the president matter? I think the president matters a lot, in large part because of their rhetoric and their disposition. It might not seem that these things are important for economic activity, for the market sphere. But you know, one of the things that economic historian Deirdre McCloskey taught us is that little over 200 years ago, we've got this what economists call a great enrichment, where prosperity really took off after humanity being poor for almost all of its existence. And she attributes that great enrichment largely to rhetoric, to a disposition to openness to others, A disposition that respects the dignity of others and is interested in innovation and interested in making sure that everyday people have what they need to make a go at life and pursue their projects. So a presidential administration that supports that kind of rhetoric and has that kind of disposition, I think, can make a big difference to the market sphere.
Let me remind listeners, this is the 21st show. We're talking about the economic policies our candidates for president are proposing in the ongoing election and the effects those could have on the U.S. economy, and especially here in Illinois in the Midwest. We're beginning this hour with Bonnie Wilson, an economist based at St. Louis University. If you want to join us, the number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. We got another text from John in Rockford talking about what presidents can and cannot do. Said, when it comes to economics, the president proposes, Congress disposes. Thank you for that, John. With that in mind, how are you seeing former President Trump and Vice President Harris's approach to economic matters differ?
That's a big question.
All right, let me narrow it down. How about let's start with inflation, because that's something we hear so much about.
Yeah. So on inflation, we both kind of chuckled at the caller's response because of the real truth in that. But on inflation, in key regards, this is not so much about the president. It's the Fed's job to keep inflation moderate, and the Fed tries to target about 2%. Now, what a president does can make that much more difficult. But really, we should rely on the Fed and be thinking about the Fed with respect to controlling inflation. Now, that said, there was recently a Wall Street Journal poll of about 50 economists, and most of them think inflation would be higher under former President Trump. And that's largely because of his plans for across-the-board tariffs. I would put forth that while if his tariff plans were to go forward, were he elected, I would certainly expect to see large increases in prices across the board, if those are across the board tariffs. Inflation, however, is really a different phenomenon than a one-shot or a gradual over time increase in prices. We might experience that, feel that as consumers, as inflation, but inflation is really long-term a monetary phenomenon, and it would be the Fed's job to try to keep that under control. Unfortunately, the way they would have to do that is by raising their target interest rates and slowing the economy down. And so that could make life difficult, really, for lots of people along two edges. Well, we would have higher prices to deal with, as well as perhaps a slowing economy.
Well, let me ask about that, because I've heard people saying that maybe Jay Powell deserves a statue in Washington after what we've been through in the last 4 years, because we had this huge spike in inflation related to the pandemic. It was a worldwide phenomenon. We had lots of supply chain interruptions and a sort of forced slowdown of the economy for that. But somehow he did, interest rates, the Fed raised interest rates. It has affected housing, but otherwise we have not had this recession that a lot of economic pundits have been warning about for years. And inflation, maybe prices are still higher, but the rate of inflation has come down. Do we need to update our economic models and thinking based on what we've seen in the past few years?
I'm not sure we need any updating. I think we saw actually a fairly textbook sort of scenario. You know, when inflation first started rising, there were sort of two camps among economists, and a main camp was called Team Transitory. And I myself was on Team Transitory. So the thinking was early on when we saw high inflation, as you noted, we had significant supply shocks due to the pandemic and supply chain disruptions, and that was driving up prices. So those of us on Team Transitory thought, once that all settles down, the supply will return back to normal and we won't see those higher prices anymore. that began to happen, but then people got back out into the world after vaccines and demand increased. So those of us who were on Team Transitory said, oh, okay, inflation's going on, but now we think it's this temporary uptick in demand as people get back out into the world. But as it turned out, many of us who were on Team Transitory decided that we'd actually been wrong. And if you look at the money supply, the money supply ticked up dramatically through that period, and inflation rose. And if you look more recently, what the Fed has done is pulled in the money supply, shrank the money supply, and inflation has come back down. In key regards, it seems fairly textbook. We are, as you mentioned, close to target on the inflation figures just out. We were just at 2.2% on PCE inflation. We are probably still, therefore, a bit above the Fed's target of 2%. But inflation is cooling, perhaps not as quickly as the Fed would like, but it's certainly cooling. And on the other side of things, the GDP level and personal income. If you go back to 2019, and look at where people in 2019 projected us to be today, the level of GDP and personal income exceeds where people would thought we would be today when they were sitting back in 2019 before the pandemic. As you pointed out, this is extraordinary. I wouldn't favor a statue for a Fed chair. I think we have a little too much idolizing for people, but it certainly is an extraordinary accomplishment that we managed the difficult to achieve so-called soft landing out of very difficult times.
All right, we are going to take a break. We will continue with Bonnie Wilson and bring some additional voices into our conversation as we talk about this year's election and specifically the presidential candidates, Kamala Harris, Donald Trump, and what they are proposing with regard to the economy. Tariffs are going to be a big focus of the next part of our conversation. If you have questions about that, if you want to join us, the number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. More to come here on the 21st show. Please stay with us. It's the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey, and we are talking for most of our program today about the economic stakes of this year's election for Illinois and here in the Midwest. And one policy proposal we've heard a lot about is the introduction of tariffs. Former President Donald Trump has made them a cornerstone of his economic policy proposals, calling for an across-the-board tariff of 10 or even 20% on every import that comes into the United States, and a tariff of 60% on goods from China. Tariffs were a significant policy tool for Trump during his first only presidential administration so far, but those policies and their consequences have had lasting effects on different parts of our economy, including many farms based here in Illinois. So with that in mind, tariffs are going to be the focus of this next part of our show. Still with us, Bonnie Wilson, Associate Professor in Economics at St. Louis University and a PhD economist from the University of Illinois. Also joining us now are two additional guests. Earlier this month, the National Corn Growers Association and the American Soybean Association put out a trade study on how new tariffs could affect soybeans and corn, two things Illinois produces quite a lot of. Krista Swanson is one of the authors of that study. She's lead economist for the Corn Growers Association. She's also a fifth-generation farmer herself based out of Knox County. Krista, welcome to the 21st show. Krista, are you with us? All right, we're going to see what is going on there. Also joining us is Jonathan Kappes. He's an associate professor in agricultural and consumer economics at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and director of the Gardner Agriculture Policy Program. And we're going to talk more in the hour with Jonathan about other stakes for the ag industry. But for now, we're going to focus on tariffs. Jonathan, welcome back to the 21st show.
Well, thank you, Brian. It's great to be back, and I appreciate being a part of this conversation. I learned a bit listening to Bonnie earlier, so that's great.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. Love to hear it. All right. So, Bonnie, I'm going to stay with you for a moment because we've heard and seen a lot from Trump on the issue of tariffs. They were part of his policy during his time as president. And in an appearance before the Economic Club of Chicago earlier this month, Trump doubled down.
We're going to bring the companies back. We're going to lower taxes still further for companies that are going to make their product in the USA. We're going to protect those companies with strong tariffs because I'm a believer in tariffs. I'm not sure that you are. I don't think you are, but I congratulate you on your career. But to me, the most beautiful word in the dictionary is tariff.
I think he was talking to the editor of Bloomberg, was his questioner there. One more short clip on this, and this is from a different Trump clip. This is from a September rally in Wisconsin. Here he's being even more specific about how he seems to think tariffs work.
We're going to be a tariff nation. It's not going to be a cost to you. It's going to be a cost to another country.
All right, a cost to another country, he says. Bonnie, how do tariffs actually work?
The basic idea behind free trade is quite simple. Adam Smith taught us when the market's small, division of labor is limited, and with it, productivity, and it's productivity that makes us rich. You enlarge the size of the market, and you get more specialization, new ideas, more productivity, more prosperity. What you're doing with tariffs is making the size of the market smaller. You are taxing economic activity. You're limiting people's willingness and ability to engage with other people who happen to reside in other sovereign nations. You're limiting their ability to do deals with them. And the reason they want to do deals with them is because it makes them better off. So we would expect tariffs to make us worse off. We would also expect tariffs and especially Trump's immigration policies to worsen the deficit and increase the debt. So Trump's take on tariffs is really quite puzzling from an economic perspective. And
won't Apple decide to just make iPhones in Texas and, you know, we'll grow more strawberries here in the winter in greenhouses? I mean, isn't the idea here that it onshores production somehow?
That may be the idea. I have my doubts that that is what will happen because there are many other places in the world for people to go. If Trump says he's going to have tariffs 10 to 20% across the board, but on China, it will be much more. So some of that production will move somewhere else. But the point is, the reason that production is not here, if people are free to locate production where they wish, is because this is not the best place for it to be. It's better for us to be doing other, more higher value added, more productive activities. So onshoring through coercive taxes, you wouldn't expect to make people better off.
So you do the things where it makes the most sense to do them, say growing corn and soybeans in Illinois and not in, you know, the mountainous areas of Colorado, for example. Jonathan, talk about the importance of international trade to Illinois and to farmers in particular.
Yeah, well, I think it's one of the things that Bonnie said that I think sticks in my head as well, trying to sort some of these things out, is that this, to the extent it's a proposal, it can be very puzzling because, you know, you're trying to understand a lot of complex issues. And frankly, he's not using it in sort of the normal policy sense of what we think of as tariffs. And this is where I think it gets critical for something like agriculture and particularly in Illinois, because what the former president seems to be thinking when he talks about tariffs is, you know, the power to punish or the power to use this sort of lever to extract something or get something out of it. And what we saw the last time in particular was that other countries also have these sorts of powers. And what you end up doing is getting retaliation and these conflicts that build on top of each other. So, for example, in 2018, when he tweeted out the first time that there was going to be the tariff on China, China retaliated against soybeans. And the state of Illinois is one of the biggest soybean, if not the biggest soybean producer in the country. And the United States is a key, you know, the biggest or second biggest soybean producer in the world. So when that retaliation happens, China goes looking for soybeans from Brazil, for example. And so what we see, and what I think is really, I think sometimes we struggle to make sense out of this because he's not talking about policy maybe in the sense we think of policy, but really what he's talking about is he wants the power to basically punish or to use these levers to punish what he sees as wrongdoing elsewhere. And I think Bonnie's right. The problem is it's going to cost us in multiple ways, but he didn't want to see it that way, right? We want to see he wants to frame it in this term of this kind of punishing tool. And it's not an end, you know, each of these actions have reactions. And I think that's where we really get concerned, particularly in the agricultural sector, because we do export a lot. It's critical, particularly on the margins and the cost issues that we have, that those markets are functional. And so the retaliation and reaction piece is where we really start to see problems.
All right. Well, Krista Swanson with the Corn Growers Association, I think we have you back with us. We were just talking. There was plenty of action on tariffs during former President Trump's term in office. How did that affect farmers in the Midwest?
Yeah, so several, or I guess I should say first, thanks for having me on since I wasn't coming through earlier. But yeah, in the 2018 trade war era, we certainly saw that have a negative impact on farmers in a couple ways. I mean, we had our trade flows, normal trade flows disrupted for that period of time while that was going on. You know, anytime, as Jonathan alluded to, exports are an important part of the total use of a crop like corn. And I'll also speak to soybeans, since our study was a partnership that we were happy to partner with American Soybean Association on. And so, you know, like for corn, exports make up about 15% of the use of corn in a given year. And China is one of the top export destinations for that corn, and especially in recent years. And so when we have those trade flows disrupted and it hurts the demand for that corn, that comes back in terms of lower price for farmers. And, you know, farmers are relying on that price point as part of their income. And Jonathan also mentioned, but you know, the U.S. agriculture sector is already going through a significant economic downturn right now. And so when we think about any situation, be it tariffs or trade related or anything that impacts the usage and can potentially have a negative impact on price, it's a really big deal anytime, but especially right now.
All right. Let me remind listeners, this is the 21st show. We're talking about the economic policies our candidates for president are proposing in the ongoing election and the effects those could have on the U.S. economy, and especially here in Illinois in the Midwest. We're talking about tariffs now and the taxes that can be placed on foreign goods being imported into the country. They've gotten to be a major policy point this year, or at least a talking point from former President Trump. And here we are, and other people are trying to make policy sense of what he has been saying on the campaign trail. And it's one that has a lot of consequences, potentially, for agriculture here in Illinois. So we're talking about this with Krista Swanson, lead economist for the National Corn Growers Association. Also, Jonathan Kappes, professor of Ag and Consumer Economics at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and Bonnie Wilson, associate professor in economics at St. Louis University. And Krista, I know your time with us is a little limited this morning, so let me come back to you right away and ask, when we talk about tariffs and the effects of those, you know, it's not just what we do, as we heard Bonnie say earlier, it's what other countries do in response. What would farmers stand to lose in Illinois if China were to, say, put a 60% tariff on our exports, our soybeans, our corn?
Yeah, so what our study showed in that case is, again, I mentioned earlier prices. So in that situation, soybean price would be estimated to fall around $1 a bushel and corn by about 12 to 13 cents a bushel per year. Again, when we're talking about a situation where farmers are already facing prices that are below their break even for corn and soybeans, thinking about further drops is a really big deal. And I would note that it goes beyond price to this situation can have, you know, long lasting impacts. It takes a long time to build trade relationships with other nations. And so when something like this happens, you know, we can find other export markets, but that doesn't happen overnight. That takes time. Another concern that our study showed that impacts farmers that is maybe longer lasting than if such a situation would come about and be relatively short lived, sort of like the 2018 scenario. We still are incentivizing production in other parts of the world. You mentioned that earlier, like where does it make the most sense to be producing a crop like corn and soybeans? And, you know, if we're incentivizing that expansion and production in other parts of the world, we've seen over the past few decades, once that new production area comes into production, it doesn't go back. And so then we are setting up for, you know, potentially more rapid expansion that is extra supply that is in the world going forward too, which, you know, is a longer lasting situation that farmers have to face.
Bonnie, what are the stakes for those of us who are not farmers if this sort of policy were to go into effect, economically speaking?
Mostly the stakes are much higher prices, also reduced GDP. I think big picture, it's important to remember that market economies are vast, complex, dynamic networks of exchange relationships. You've heard that from both Jonathan and Krista in the specific area of agriculture. These trade is cooperation, it's relationship, it's win-win games. And we want as many win-win games as we can get. And we would have fewer of them, and that's not good for people.
It's win-win, but there are losers, right? And do you see that is something that maybe one of the things that Trump has tapped into, the anger over, you know, it goes back to NAFTA in some cases. We see a lot of working class voters moving to the Republican Party, the some college or no college, the workers who, you know, might have worked at that Maytag plant in Galesburg that moved to Mexico a generation ago now.
Yeah, certainly when we open the opportunity for people to choose who they trade with, they're sometimes going to switch and stop trading with their neighbor and start trading with a neighbor who's much further away in another country. And so there's a strong argument to be made if we want to maintain a relatively economic free society that we need to cushion people from those sorts of labor market shocks and help them get back on their feet and get back into productive work. What that shifting does is create the opportunity for more productive work. But we need entrepreneurs and innovators having the freedom to step in, to build those opportunities. And we probably need to help give people a cushion and find their way to those places.
Krista, I know you need to run in a couple of minutes here, but I just want to read a brief excerpt from your study. Quote, while dollar value impacts can represent losses in export value or value of production, these studies cannot account for the permanent implication from the loss of the United States' reputation with trading partners. Talk a little bit more about how we'd see that manifest.
Yeah, so I alluded to this a little bit already, but you know, it can take years, it can take decades to build new markets for our corn. I'll also speak to soybeans, and you know, not just corn and soybeans, but also the value-added products that corn and soybeans are in, like meats and ethanol or biofuels. And so when we think about creating new markets to send those products to, it takes a long time to build that up. And so something like this can have a damage that reputation that we have as a reliable and a reliable provider of top-notch products. And so that's a concern that's long lasting and can have impacts, you know, again, even if a tariff situation and retaliation is lasts a year, those types of impacts can last much longer.
Krista Swanson, lead economist for the National Corn Growers Association. Thank you for being with us today on the 21st show.
Thank you.
And I'm also going to say at this point, goodbye to Bonnie Wilson, associate professor in economics at St. Louis University. Thank you for being with us today. It was really informative. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure, Brian. Thanks for the conversation. Bye-bye.
Bye. And we're going to ask Jonathan Coppes, professor of agricultural and consumer economics at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, to stay with us And we're going to talk more about ag beyond tariffs and what policies, specifically Project 2025, might bring. Also, the Harris administration, some of what they've talked about. We're going to dive into ag and the presidential election when we return. If you want to join us, 800-222-9455. If you're already called in and have talked to one of our producers, you're holding on the line, please. We're going to get to you right after the break. Stay with us. Again, if you want to join, 800-222-9455. More on the economy and agriculture and the presidential election when we return. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We've been spending most of our program today on economic policies in this year's presidential election. Still with us for the last part of our hour today is Jonathan Kappes, Associate Professor in Agricultural and Consumer Economics at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He's also Director of the Gardner Agriculture Policy Program there. Before we go and move on to ag and Project 2025 and related issues, we did have a caller on the tariffs issue. I want to get that person on the line at 800-222-9455. Alfonso is calling from Mahomet on line two. Alfonso, thanks for calling in.
Can you hear me?
I can.
Yeah, so it's really unfortunate that the two economists left. I will say in passing, it, with respect to what the first economist said, the economy is really quite good. Democrats have done an abysmal job of messaging that, and that might factor into their possible loss next week. But specifically with tariffs, and the agricultural economist would have had a better recollection of the history on this, but remember that Trump did impose tariffs when he was president, and China imposed retaliatory tariffs on agricultural goods. So there was some form of federal financial relief to farmers, including farmers in Illinois, to offset the impact of the retaliatory tariffs. And so this is the American taxpayer is getting it both ways. They're getting hit with the higher prices from the tariffs, and they're getting hit with their tax money going to subsidize farmers because of a misguided policy. And, you know, this is some definition of socialism.
Right. The political pundit in me, the sort of cynical political person would say, you know, the farmers in the agricultural areas tend to vote overwhelmingly for former President Trump in these elections, tend to be insulated from the consequences of that decision.
Okay. Which is exactly what I was going to say next. But I wrote a letter to the News Gazette at the time, and I said that, you know, not only is the taxpayer getting hit twice, but you've now reduced farmers to welfare queens.
All right, Alfonso, thank you so much for calling in with that. Jonathan Kappes, I don't want to sleep on your skill set here. Do you want to weigh in on what Alfonso had to say?
Well, I got to tell you, one of the things that Alfonso made the point, and I kind of feel the same way, that we take the economists away. Now I don't have the handrails, and I'm sort of stumbling down the stairs in the dark. So, you know, we'll try to get through this. I think there's a bigger, more important point here, which is, again, kind of going back to this issue. We get lost in some of the specific details, but the thing that I keep thinking about as we roll through this tariff conversation is not just the policy component, but the way in which it's used and the messages, the sort of power dynamic that goes around that. And what the 2018 example, again, what it showed us was that America doesn't get to just throw tariffs into the system and not have some sort of reaction. Prices will go up for consumers. We know that. Prices will go up for businesses. We know that because all these things will begin to cost more that we import. And the former president is using this in this sort of punitive manner to what you mentioned about NAFTA and the other challenges we've seen in many communities for many jobs and many people. But it's sort of like smashing things with a tariff because of the problems that came out of those other earlier issues. And the problem is you don't get to do that without repercussions and consequences. And again, we saw that. And so then each thing kind of builds from there. So we had the retaliation from China. Then we throw roughly $8 and then $15 billion in payments to try to offset that. And it continues to kind of ripple through a variety of issues now. Those payments will tend to boost or add to the cost pressures that farmers face, which pinches them even further now when prices come down. And so I think it has to be, you know, we can really wrap ourselves around these specific details and miss this sort of bigger picture issue, which is the idea for using tariffs in this case is not to, you know, address imbalances or something. He's really using this in a punitive sense. He wants voters to put him in office to give him the power to enact this kind of punitive measure, and that will cause, depending on what it does, it could cause massive ripple effects through our economy and through the world economy and many geopolitical issues. And so I do think there's a big problematic set of issues around this.
All right, let's get another caller in. Alexander is calling from Belvedere on line one. Alexander, thank you for calling.
Let me say one thing, okay? Yeah. Hello?
Yep, go ahead, Alexander.
Do you feel as though you're better off now than you were 4 years ago?
I'll leave the listeners to make their own assessments for that, but go ahead.
I'm asking you.
Me? Yeah, I personally do. I'm very happy. I've got a good job. My wife has a good job. Yeah, I'm fine.
No, but I'm talking about the cost of living.
Yeah, I'm in a lucky position, I guess.
You make a lot of money. I don't know. I don't know if you make a lot of money, but the average person would say no. When I go to the grocery store, I go to the gas station, I get medical, whatever. They are not feeling better about this. That's the American people.
All right. So you had wanted to make a point. You told our producer you wanted to talk about fair trade, and it sounds like you're a supporter of this tariffs idea.
To a certain point.
Are you concerned when you hear the economists say this could cause real chaos in our economy? Do you have worries about it, or do you think they're full of baloney?
Well, I'm not going to say that, but I'm going to say I just like to exercise common sense, which isn't very common today. And what I say is, if you feel like you're better off than you were 4 years ago, well, then you know how to vote. But I can tell you the majority of the people I know, and I'm open-minded to this. I don't care. As long as it's good for the United States, I'm a patriot. I'm not a Republican. I'm not a Democrat. I'm a United States patriot. I spent 4 years in the Marine Corps, went to Vietnam 2 years, and I can see what's going on. And we're not using common sense in this administration.
All right. Alexander, thank you so much for sharing your perspective with us today. I appreciate it. All right. Let me remind listeners, this is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey, and we have been talking about economic policy around this year's presidential election. For the rest of the show, I do want to focus, since we have an agriculture expert with us, Jonathan Kopess, who's a professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. I want to focus on some of the ag policies. We're going to have to move kind of quickly here, but Jonathan, let's talk about. There's been so much attention on Project 2025, which is a document compiled by the Heritage Foundation as a plan for the next Republican administration. It mentions some of the policy proposals we've talked about. When you look at what, you know, Republicans have called for, and you look at what's in Project 2025 in terms of agriculture, what are your broad takeaways?
Yeah, well, it's not an easy thing to necessarily digest and put together because there's a lot there. But in the ag space in particular, a couple things that jump out at me first and foremost. A lot of it is, and I don't mean to be negative about it, but a lot of it is sort of recycled think tank ideas about let's end farm program payments, let's end crop insurance subsidies, let's end the federal subsidy for purchasing crop insurance, let's end the SNAP program and those sort of things. So I think there's a lot of that, and frankly, that goes to Congress. All of those things are part of the Farm Bill authorization or reauthorization process. And so, again, it's sort of recycling this kind of demand that we make those changes. Where I get really concerned when I look at this proposal, the two things that jump out at me, the first is sort of the disruptive potential around the civil service, around getting rid of agency people and public servants in these agencies and departments, and beginning to try to think through the chaos or the disruption that could cause in a variety of things. So using USDA just in particular, right? one of the fundamental things that we need every day from USDA are the meat inspectors and the ability to make sure our meat products are safe, the products on our shelves are safe. For companies, you can't sell those products if they're not inspected. So what kind of disruption happens when, you know, somebody is enacting this kind of, you know, getting people out of the agencies? Even things like crop insurance require professional public servants in these agencies, farm program payments, conservation technical assistance, all of these things that farmers use require these individuals within the government, within the agency. So there's a series of those kind of consequences. And then I think the other thing that comes back to, again...
And Project 2025, to your point on inspection. No. But I mean, it one of the things it does say is that that should no longer be a federal function. Just leave it to the states. What do you think about that?
Well, again... all of these products travel interstate? It's not a state level. Like, I don't even know a state that would have the functional capability to take that on, particularly in a really rapid way from the federal government. And it just ignores the way this entire system functions to, frankly, you know, kind of push what is a perspective that, again, seems much more think tank idealism than actual implementation and operation. It worries me that the consequences are not considered if somebody were to try to enact those ideas.
Well, and one of the things here is that, you know, there are all these changes in policies that could come about. At a larger level, this is about institutional change and what happens because of it, right? A lot of these policies are up to the executive branch through the Department of Agriculture. And one of the things that Trump's campaign has proposed is getting rid of a lot of civil service employees and replacing them with political loyalists. What happens if the expertise in these agencies gives way to people who have different priorities?
I mean, the expertise is critical for running the programs and operating all that these agencies and departments do. And again, I come back to my higher level issue, which is, you know, whether we can nitpick and pick apart each little piece of this and try to, you know, at the end of the day, what this indicates is, should power be entrusted into the former president, what he's signaling is he wants to use that power in these sorts of ways. Will he specifically end you know, farm program payments? Will he specifically send meat inspection to the states? Who knows? But he wants to be able to have the power to do that. And it doesn't, what it worries me reading that again is there's no seemingly understanding of the consequences or the operational realities of doing so.
Well, and this is at a time, something that's one of my hobby horses is Congress has for generations now continued to abdicate or give up its own power and hand it over to the executive branch. And we've seen a crystal clear example of that with the Farm Bill in recent years, right?
Well, yeah, that's certainly been a big challenge in Congress as we've seen a lot of this polarization and dysfunction really come home to the ag committees and the Farm Bill, where it's become an extraordinarily partisan, particularly around the food assistance programs. And then that just sort of unravels the coalition that you need to get a bill through Congress. And again, watching it this last couple years, you're just left with questions about what the end game is. What's the point of some of this, you know, that seems very counterproductive and is not accomplishing really anything on behalf of the constituents.
You had one sentence, you were quoted in an article on The Hill, or in The Hill, I guess, The Hill, the publication The Hill, not the place, the Capitol Hill, but The Hill is about The Hill. Anyway, your quote was, "It's not their success that we should be concerned about, it's failure while getting super creative and trying. That's what leads to real chaos." What did you mean by that?
Well, exactly the thing I'm sort of trying to, I struggle to always put these pieces together, but it really comes down to this, you know, will they achieve all of the ideological goals in that document? No, nobody ever does. What we should be concerned about is in trying it, in sort of the chaotic disruption that happens from throwing experts out of agencies or trying to force states to take over meat inspection. It's what happens because of that that is unpredictable and is not thought through in some of these proposals. And so it's failing. It's actually trying it and making a mess of things. And then what do you do?
Yeah. And we're almost out of time, but how would you respond to somebody who's listening? Maybe like some of our callers who say, you know what we've been doing hasn't been working for me. My costs are high. I can't afford the things I want to afford. You know, the plant closed in my town. My kids left town because there's no work opportunities here for them. So maybe we need someone to disrupt things. And that seems to be Trump's appeal. What do you say to them?
Well, I think that's a very good read of a lot of the frustration we're seeing with individuals. And again, we struggle to explain it and work through it. And things like the, you know, economic data compare and measurements compared to what people feel when they go to the grocery store. Those are very difficult things. When you say, yeah, you know, inflation's coming down, but no, my bill every time I go to the grocery store is higher because the inflation's been built in over time. Again, I think the thing that I try to think through is how this dynamic works out when you entrust power to individuals who look to take that power and sort of break things or really disrupt things. Our system needs to kind of work through these set of processes and the ways in which it's designed to implement policy and operate. And so I don't know that we see a better result simply because we kind of smash things up in the frustration with how things are. I wish there was an easier and better answer. And I think that's part of our challenge is the search for simple and easy answers kind of leads us astray from the really tough work that has to go into this.
I'm going to get a tattoo that says it's complicated. Jonathan Kopess, Associate Professor in Agricultural and Consumer Economics at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Great talking with you as always. Thanks for your time.
Hey, thank you very much for having me on.
And that's all the time we have for our show today. The 21st Show is produced by Anna Casey, Christine Hatfield, and Jose Zepeda. Our digital producer is Kulsum Khan. Technical direction and engineering from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick's our news director. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thank you for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.